So on Friday evening, this Friday, the 24th, we're having a kind of a celebration, a ceremony. The celebration is in part to celebrate our one-year anniversary here, and in part to install the statue that's now kind of in the back there, that's covered by this kind of shawl, this blanket, so you can't see what it is. And what it is a statue of Mahapajapati, who was the first Buddhist nun. And so we're going to install that and use that as an occasion to kind of, in some way, celebrate and honor the history of women in Buddhism, the women nuns, the women teachers, the women practitioners down through the ages. And so we have this kind of event that's been planned. It's somewhat of a ceremony, and we're going to reenact the story of how Mahapajapati asked the Buddha for women to be ordained. And there's various things planned for that evening. It should be quite nice, I think. So if you'd like to come for that, it's at 7 o'clock and 7 to 9. And I don't know much more I want to say about that right now, about the ceremony, but everybody's welcome to come. And it would be nice to have a couple of people who could come and help set up the... if there's a couple of people who come at 4 o'clock in the afternoon to help set up for the event, that would be really appreciated. Is anybody here? I could also ask Monday evening, but anybody here would like to come at 4 and help set up? Thank you. No one? Okay, so I'll ask tomorrow also. And then also, if people come, we'd also need someone to help clean up afterwards. So people who can come to clean up, I don't know if anybody wants to volunteer now or at the time, but we'll have kind of refreshments afterwards, little cookies and some refreshments and drinks for people to mill around and talk after as part of the event, kind of at the end. And then we have to clean that all up. So it's we're all kind of making the event happen together. And so hopefully people who come would like to participate in that way. It should be simple. So what I'd like to do this morning is what I did last Monday, is to talk a little bit more in detail about why we're installing the statue of the first Buddhist nun here at our center and a little bit behind it. And it's a little bit repetitive from last Monday, and hopefully I'll do it from a little different angle for those of you who were here. As I was thinking about this talk, I was thinking that actually it's focusing on a number, has a number of different purposes, if I can pull it off. One is very simple, is to kind of give the background for why we're doing this installation of a particular statue. Another is to talk a little bit about element of history of Buddhism, which has to do with women's ordination as nuns and how it's been for women to be nuns in this tradition. And then kind of weaving through that little bit is the issue of how do you interpret facts? You know, the raw kind of stories that we get. How do you interpret history of Buddhism? How do you translate Buddhism into a Western cultural setting when, you know, when you read texts and read stories and read teachings that come from a time and place that was in ancient India 2,500 years ago? How do you translate? How do you understand? How do we understand it? How do we go into that kind of world? Do we understand it through the filter of our own situation here, our own philosophies, our own worldviews, our own cultural conditioning? Or do we somehow learn to kind of put aside our particular situation in order to see those teachings kind of in a fresh way or see it in their own context and not judge it by our standards? So these are kind of some of the things that I'd like to do today. So the story, I want to start by the story of Mahapajapati. And it's a very, we don't know much about her life. But we have a few details, as recorded by someone in ancient times. And then that raises the question of, are the records of the Buddha's teachings, the records of the life of the Buddha, accurate depictions of what the Buddha was all about? They were said to be written down in writing some 500 years after he lived, and probably later than that. That's kind of the history. 1,000 years after the Buddha died, there's a record of someone writing that 500 years after the Buddha died, They wrote it down. They wrote down his discourses in writing. So how do you, what do you make of that? And we have recovered from the sands of Afghanistan, actually birch bark documents of ancient discourses of the Buddha that come probably from around the turn of the millennia, around the year zero. So about 500 years after the Buddha, we have some record of the Buddha's discourses being written down. So how do you understand these things? You know, are they, was this, were these, you know, accurate reporters who was just writing down, you know, how things were in ancient times? Even nowadays, we're not just sure about our reporters. So, you know, how do we understand these things? And it's an important issue because people do understand them in some ways, and then some people get angry or they get inspired. But, you know, based on what they think is, you know, actually happened. But we don't know, do we? So, so there's not that much written about Mahapajapati, but this is what we know about her. She, her name means, Maha means great, Pajapati means leader of an assembly, leader of a group of people. And in fact, it was kind of like foretold at her birth that she would be a leader of an assembly of people. And in a sense, she became the leader of the nuns' order, first leader kind of the Buddhist nuns' order. And Gotami, Mahapajapati Gotami, Gotami is her clan name, her family name, same as the Buddha. He was part of the same clan, Gotama. And she had a sister by the name of Mahamaya. Maha also means great. Maya, as my understanding in Sanskrit and Pali, means illusion. Why she was named Mahamaya, I don't know. But both of those sisters married a king by the name of Suddhodana, I think. Mahamaya gave birth to the Buddha, or the man who would become the Buddha. The sister, with the same husband, gave birth to two children. Nanda, her son, I don't remember her daughter's name. But Mahamaya, the mother of Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, she died when the Buddha was 7 days old. And what has been pointed out is a lot of the great religious leaders of human history lost their one or both parents early in their lives when they were still children. Something about that suffering, that condition, that is a condition for encouraging some people to take that phenomenal leap of faith, leap of dedication or something to really plunge into the depths of the spiritual life that kind of cracked open human history in certain ways. And human history is not different since because of these people and what they did, how they lived, the risks they took. So the Buddha's mother died when he was 7 days old. And so Mahapajapati raised the Buddha as her own son. She was in the same family, after all. It was not so odd in the ancient world for two women to marry the same man. And she was the nursemaid, or she nursed the Buddha, and she was kind of his mother, in a sense, raised the Buddha. At some point, Siddhartha Gautama left the palace, left that life that he was living, and went off to become a renunciant and pursue his spiritual life, and became the Buddha. At some point then, he returned to his home place. And there's a lot of stories about what that was like. And in one of these visits to his home place, at that time, the king had died. His father had died, which meant that Mahapajapati was now a widow. And by this time, her son, Nanda, had also become a nun, a monk, to follow the Buddha. In ancient India, and still to this day to some degree, a woman's position in society, her status, her safety, was somewhat determined by who the men she was related to. And now her husband was dead, and her son, who would then follow kind of in the responsibility of caring for the women, had gone off, left the home life, and gone off and become a monk. And it's also been said that a number of the women in Buddha's home place had become, in a sense, monastic widows, because their husbands had been so inspired by the Buddha that they had also gone off and become monks. So here was, and they had gone to Mahapajapati as their supporter, as their benefactor, as their kind of protector, because they had no longer had these men to protect them, or whatever in the ancient world was important. And they were inspired by the example of the Buddha, by his spiritual teachings, that they too wanted to follow the path of freedom, of peace that he had to offer. And they wanted to do that at this point in their life as renunciants, as nuns. So Mahapajapati went to the Buddha and asked, could women be ordained? Would you allow us to be ordained? And the Buddha did not say no, which is usually how this statement has been interpreted. And maybe it's as good as no. Maybe it's kind of a polite ancient Indian way of saying no, because you don't want to say no directly. But he literally didn't say no. What he said was, enough. Don't ask this question. So what does that mean? Don't ask this question. And so she asked twice more, she asked. And twice more, the Buddha said, enough, don't ask these questions. And so then Mahapajapati left the Buddha in tears, quite sad at this event. The Buddha then left his home place, went wandering around northern India, and went some 150 miles away. And then Mahapajapati and this group of nuns, the group of women that she had around her, decided to go and visit the Buddha where he was, follow him. And they really wanted to become ordained, be renunciants. They shaved their heads, which is one of the things renunciants did in ancient India. And they got rid of all their regular, ordinary clothes. Some of them were, you know, kind of wealthy women. Got rid of their jewels. And they became, and they put on renunciant garb, kind of the robes of renunciant. And they walked across northern India, the 150 miles. And from the story, we imagine that perhaps that they were not very fit. They were used to maybe palace life, some of these, and not used to being very physically active. And so walking, you know, barefoot, as a renunciant would, across northern India, 150 miles, they became caked with dust, the story tells us, and their legs and feet got quite swollen. So it was arduous trip. And they finally arrived to where the Buddha was, and he was inside a building. And they didn't go in, but rather they stood outside the building crying. And Ananda, who was the Buddha's main attendant, came out of the building one time and saw them standing there. He knew them all because he was of the same clan, same family. Ananda was the Buddha's cousin. And he said, well, what's going on here? And they said, well, we wanted to be ordained as nuns and follow the spiritual life in its fullness that's possible. But the Buddha would not let us. And Ananda said, oh, well, let me go ask him. So the Buddha went and asked, Ananda went and asked the Buddha. And each time Ananda asked, the Buddha said the same thing, enough, don't ask these questions. Ananda asked three times. But Ananda then said, well, I'll take a different tact. And so then Ananda said to the Buddha, is it not true that women have the capacity to become fully enlightened? And the Buddha said, yes. Now, in ancient India, as far as we can know, this was a very radical thing to say. There's some evidence that the only other nuns' order that existed at the time was among the Jains. And the story in the Jains is that women could be nuns and renunciants, but they didn't have the capacity of becoming fully liberated in the Jain system unless they somehow became men. And generally that was done by being reborn as a man at some point. So in some sense, the possibility of full awakening, full freedom, was kind of a new thing for someone to say, this is possible for women. So he said, yes, it's possible. He acknowledged that. And then Ananda asked a second question, or said something else. He said, is it not true that Mahapajapati raised you as her own son? She nursed you with her own breast milk. And the Buddha said, yes. And then Ananda said, it would be good if the Buddha would agree to ordain the women. And so he said, okay. However, on eight conditions, Mahapajapati has to agree to eight conditions. If she agrees to these eight conditions, then she can be a nun. And the eight conditions are all things in some way or other establish the nun's order subservient to the monks. The first condition was that any nun, even if she's been ordained 100 years, has to bow down to even a very new novice monk. And seniority is very important in India and in traditional Buddhism. So, like, for example, monks are always supposed to bow to someone who's more senior to them, but not someone who's more junior to them. So if the nuns were outside, you know, any even novice monk who was, you know, 16 years old or 12 years old, the nuns had to bow to him, regardless of how senior they were and how enlightened they were. And no nun was allowed to admonish a monk. The monks are allowed to admonish nuns. Another one of the conditions is that in order for a monk to be ordained, you need a quorum of about five monks to have a valid monk's ordination. In order to have a valid nun's ordination, you have to have a certain quorum of nuns present, and you have to have a certain quorum of monks present. So women were not an independent organization. They couldn't decide who to ordain on their own, but were dependent on the monks in order to do the ordination. So Mahapajapati agreed to this, and then Ananda then had permission then to ordain the other women that were with her. Later, Mahapajapati, after she was a nun, well, then the story goes on, says that she went on then and received a meditation subject from the Buddha, a meditation practice, and she went on to become fully ordained, fully enlightened. And she became, in a sense, the founder of the nun's order, the leader of the nun's order, and is considered by some people as being like kind of a great mother figure in Buddhism. She was the mother for the Buddha, raised him. She was the kind of the mother helped found the nun's order through her persistence and her efforts. Sometime later, she went to the Buddha and asked him if he would change some of these eight conditions. And she asked him if he would change the first one, that could he please change this so that it was more of an egalitarian system where nuns bow to anybody who's more senior to them, but not anybody who's more junior to them, monk or nun. So establish the two orders kind of the same level. And the Buddha said no. He said, basically he said that wasn't a good idea. Mahapajapati said she lived to be 120 years old, and said that when she was about to die, she asked the Buddha to come and see her. And this was considered to be a breach of protocol, because a nun wasn't supposed to ask a monk for things like that, to come to her. But the Buddha came to her and ministered to her as she was dying. So that's kind of like the basic facts, more or less. Then the question is, how do we interpret that? And it was the Buddha misogynist, you know, by having this, you know, first being reluctant to ordain women, and then, you know, reluctantly, you know, doing it, but then saying, well, there are these eight conditions that we're going to keep women subservient to monks. And is this misogynist? Is this terrible? Is someone who's fully enlightened, like the Buddha, he should have known better than that. He should have been, you know, egalitarian from day one and treated everyone equally. Or how do we understand it? Do we understand it through the cultural conditions of the time? And that the Buddha, doing what he did, allowing for a nun's order to be created, was he doing it? It was such a radical thing to do in that society that the only way it could be acceptable in society by everyone was to have these conditions in that particular time and place. So it was a big leap forward for women at that time, allowing women to go forth away from the protection of men to exist independent as nuns. But in order for that to be something that was acceptable, and, you know, the nuns had to be supported by the people around them, there had to be these conditions in place Do we understand it culturally like that? Do we understand it, as some people want to do, was the Buddha never did that. The Buddha wasn't reluctant to ordain women. The Buddha didn't set those eight conditions. This was done several hundred years later when there was a nun's order, and we have evidence that the nun's order, about 200, 300, 400 years after the Buddha, was phenomenally successful. It was very active, very dynamic, a very great power of spirituality in ancient India. And the monks were threatened. And so they slipped in, as they were writing down these texts, you know, for the first time, 500 years later, they slipped in these little things that kind of put women in their place. You know, then it's canonical, then it's, you know, it's authoritative, right? Is that what happened? That's what some people interpret. How do you interpret it? You know, so people, you know, who knows? I don't know how to interpret it. And then and there's very personal interpretations I've heard. Is Buddha's reluctance to ordain Mahapajapati was not about women's situation and what women, whether he thought women should or shouldn't be ordained. But rather, Mahapajapati was kind of uppity. She was the queen. She was used to getting her way. She had this. She was the, you know, kind of his mother after all, and she had to in some way be kind of humbled, and so or could be ready to receive, you know. And so Buddha said no until she was kind of you know really determined and ready to kind of approach him in a more humble way or more something. That's one interpretation I've heard. How do we interpret it? You know, I don't know. I'm very impressed by the figure of Mahapajapati with the little stories we've heard, and I'm impressed by, you know, her persistence, her strength of character. I'm impressed by the fact that after she was ordained, she still went back to the Buddha to question him on these eight conditions. And to, you know, in a sense, I see her as being symbolic for egalitarian forces in Buddhism, for democratic forces in Buddhism, and for feminist forces in Buddhism, which periodically has showed itself in the tradition. That's one of the things that characterizes Buddhism in the West, as many some commentators have pointed out for some time now, is that as Buddhism has got established here in America, it's been under very strong pressure to become egalitarian, to become democratic, and become more feminist. And the strongest impetus for this started, kind of really recognizable impetus for this, said probably started in the late 70s, early 80s. And I remember in the 1980s, there was a lot of movement among women to demanding, asking for more egalitarian roles in the Buddhist communities in America, where in the 70s, early 70s, there was still, as our culture often had, a kind of split between opportunities available to women and authority available to them and that of men. And there were a lot of inspired women's gatherings. Still happen to some degree, but in the 1980s, a lot of inspired women Buddhists gathering together to talk about how it was to be a woman in Buddhism, to find new language, new way of understanding the practice. So I kind of like to see Mahapajapati that way. She represents one of these forces within Buddhism. And you know, kind of, she's kind of like the mother of Buddhism, whereas the Buddha maybe is the father of Buddhism. And you see in this period, about 300 years after the Buddha, when the nun's order was very, very strong, you see Mahapajapati being elevated to a status virtually equal to that of the Buddha and honored and respected and seen as an inspiration, as a role model for women's opportunity to be enlightened. So then I'll tell you a little story of how one Tibetan nun, Western Tibetan nun, dared go to the Dalai Lama and teach him something new. There was a Western Buddhist teachers meeting in Dharamsala in the early 90s. And the Western Buddhist teachers of all different traditions met just to kind of meet as a fellow Buddhist teachers, talk about issues they had in common. And there was one Western nun, Tibetan nun, I think it was Tenzin Palmo, who's been around now and quite popular. At some point in this meeting with Dalai Lama, she said to him, "I'd like to teach you a new practice. Are you willing?" new visualization. The Tibetans do a lot of visualizations. He said, sure. He said, close your eyes and imagine that you're going to go receive teachings from this great enlightened person, great Buddha, and you come to the monastery or the place and you're, you know, welcomed in to the big hall where the teachings are going to be. And you said, oh, you can sit here in the back of the hall. We're very happy that you're here, but sit here in the back. And he looks around and he sees that this is where the men sit. And at the front, near where the teacher is, are all the women. And they can really hear well what's being said. And then the Buddha who's sitting up there teaching is a woman. And then look around the hall, and there's all these pictures and statues of all the great enlightened disciples and teachers down through the ages. And they're all women. And at this point in the story, the Dalai Lama, doing this visualization, started crying. And he said, I didn't understand. And he said, we have to change this. So there's a legacy history of Buddhism being very male-dominated. Buddhism is, you know, a lot of the teaching stories in Buddhism are teaching stories of men. The stories of the women teachers, women practitioners, those stories tend to get lost down through time. They're not preserved in the same way. And so what surfaces and what remains is the teachings of the women, of the men. So in the 1980s and 1990s, there's been a movement then to try to find images, role models, teachings by women, of women, as to be used in the Western Dharma scene. The San Francisco Zen Center in the 1980s got a beautiful statue of Tara, a Tibetan female embodiment of compassion, to put right next to the Buddha in the Buddha Hall, the ceremonial hall, as a kind of model of women's potential. And they also started chanting the lineage, or not the lineage, but building into their liturgy in the morning, reciting the names of all the different women who were enlightened at the time that we have their names of, who are disciples of the Buddha. Maybe 20, 25 different women we know of. At Spirit Rock, there was many things happened there along, you know, for women. But one of the things that happened was that they started putting up all these images of women around the meditation hall. The old meditation hall, there's one guy, you know, statue, the Buddha. And then around, there's all these women, like five or six different kind of women, female images. Several of Avalokiteshvara, and I think there's one even of a Hindu goddess in the meditation hall. And however, at Spirit Rock, they're all mythological figures, archetypical figures. Even now in the main meditation hall, the retreat meditation hall, there is a statue of a Buddha. And right next to it, same size, kind of so sharing the space on the altar, equal position, a statue of a woman. Beautiful statue. But it's not a real person, a real woman. It's a statue of not even a mythological person in a sense. It's the personification of wisdom in the form of a woman. Prajna Paramita. The Theravadan tradition that we're part of tends to be kind of down to earth and not so mythologically oriented, archetypical oriented. And so I thought that more in line of our tradition, it would be nice to have an historical woman to be the role model, to be the kind of example of not only the potential, the role model for women, but also a reminder of the egalitarian, democratic, and feminist forces within Buddhism. And so I thought that Mahapajapati, who had that role in certain periods in Buddhist history of Buddhism, would work really well for us as that. And actually, it wasn't for us originally. I just thought it'd be good to do this for Spirit Rock for someone. And this was about 10 years ago. I mentioned it to this Lorraine Caporel, who is an artist. And she said she would like to make that sculpture. And then a year ago, she came back to me and said, I am now ready to make it. But I don't want to make it for anybody else. I want to make it for IMC, for your center here. So I said, great. And so she did. And a Sangha member paid to have it bronzed for us. So we have this beautiful bronze statue that's underneath a blanket out there. And we will then, on Friday, unveil it and have this event that has been designed and choreographed to be symbolic in various ways. And I shouldn't give too much away, but you should, during the ceremony, you should at least think a little bit about the symbolism of some of the things that went going on. You'll be tickled, I think, especially if you're a woman. Don't be angry by the first thing you encounter when you do part of it, because the ceremony is not just simply meant to celebrate and honor and respect the position of women in Buddhism down through the centuries, but I felt it was appropriate also to somehow, as part of the ceremony, give shape to the suffering and the pain, the silencing of women that's also been in Buddhism. I don't want us to say that Buddhism has been just great for women. And so there'll be something very simple that enacts that. And so please don't get angry with me. It's just part of the enactment, part of the ceremony that we do that. So hopefully that inspires you to come and see what we're doing rather than inspires you to stay away. It should be quite nice. I've invited a number of women teachers to come and be part of it, half a dozen or so. And they'll have little roles as part of it. So it would be nice to say that enlightenment, freedom, is something that doesn't belong to cultural conditionings, doesn't belong to gender, doesn't belong to status, doesn't belong to ethnicity, doesn't belong to nationality, doesn't belong to religion even. That the mind that is free, the heart that is at peace, that has realized the ultimate, is somehow outside of all those conditions. And, you know, I believe that's the case. However, we cannot live our lives separated from the conditions of our lives. We cannot live separated from our culture so well. Some people try more, better, for little more or less. We cannot live separate from the conditioning that we've received from our society. We cannot live separate from what it means to be a particular gender and a particular society that assigns meaning to it. And so my hope is that Buddhist practice helps to clarify and highlight and help us understand our conditioning so that the shadows of it, the hidden assumptions of it, the ways in which we're blind about how we treat each other and ourselves based on that conditioning, based on the cultural things. The practice highlights and brings it out so that as we live a life that becomes freer and freer, more an expression of love and care, compassion, that we're slowly also ferreting out those places where we're still culturally blind or where there are places we're still conditioned. Every culture, I believe, including a little culture like IMC, our meditation center here, will have shadow sides, sides that we don't want to admit or look at very carefully. Or, you know, for example, Buddhist groups tend to put a lot of emphasis on loving kindness and compassion. And what happens as a group, culturally, if you emphasize those things, then it kind of feels a little uncomfortable to show up and be grumpy. You know, or kind of be irritated and, you know, angry, you know, with people, you know, because, you know, all these people, you know, they're going to judge you negatively. You know, you're supposed to be kind when you come to Buddhist groups, right? And so then, if you feel irritated or angry or something, then you kind of, well, I'm not going to show that part of myself because, you know, these people are not going to like it. So then it kind of, what's called then, it's put then in the shadow, in the kind of the corners, in the darkness. It's not. So I believe it's my kind of little homespun philosophy that every culture has this kind of shadow side. And we can't do, you know, it's going to be there no matter what. But it's the function of the practice of mindfulness, of meditation, to, if there's some way in which that is operating, where we're held or restricted or held not free because of it, that it becomes highlighted. And so the cultures, one of the functions of the practice is to highlight the difficulties, highlight the shadows, so they don't sit and fester. So one of the beautiful aspects of mindfulness is it highlights how things actually are in the present moment. And if you're angry, it highlights that. And then we learn the skills of how to deal with it honestly and not keep it hidden. The mindfulness practice also, at the very same time, is a vehicle for becoming free. Learning how to become free in the midst of our anger, perhaps, or in a healthy way becoming free of our anger, or the mindfulness practice becomes a kind of a finger or an aid or a vehicle to discovering or to remembering what the mind that doesn't cling is like, the heart that does not put up boundaries or barriers or restrictions, the unrestricted mind, the unrestricted heart. So part of the beauty of mindfulness is that at the same time it can have a number of different functions. Because the emphasis is always to really clarify what's happening in the present moment. And it becomes hopefully a safer place or a healthy place to really clearly understand what's happening in the present moment and then hold it in a much larger container of freedom, of liberation, of mind, of compassion and freedom. So I don't think of IMC as being a perfect meditation center. I don't think of myself as being a particularly good meditation teacher for IMC. But what I think we have here is we have fantastic practice that I would hopefully we all share and all kind of learn, find the opportunities at IMC to practice it. Or if you feel that the opportunities are not here in some way, or feel somehow that the language or the way the teachings are given or where the community is organized or the way the community is, in some way makes someone feel uncomfortable, feels like, oh, the door's not open for me so well, that somehow that this is a place where that can be spoken, that can be some vehicle for clarifying that and working with it, because it's the practice that's supposed to help us find the way forward and find our freedom as both individuals and as a community. So I don't offer IMC as a perfect place. But I offer it as a place, hopefully, where the practice of mindfulness that we all have, whether it's private or publicly, is a place where everything can come out in the wash and be worked out and be clarified. And that's where I find the hope, is in the practice. So in installing the statue of Ma Pajapati, I hope that we remember all kinds of things. I hope we remember the forces of speaking honestly how we are and what our intentions and motivations are, just like Mahapajapati did. She's a very motivated person. And I hope we also are willing to speak up when we feel that the forces of egalitarianism and democracy and feminism, I suppose, are not being lived out in the way that you feel they should be lived out. And I hope that the statue of Ma Pajapati is a reminder to all of us, not just women, but to all of us, that the possibility of freedom, of enlightenment, is something that we're all capable of, and that is not something of mythological figures. Because sometimes the Buddha can appear kind of almost like a mythological figure, an archetype. And I hope that Ma Pajapati brings us down to earth. So that's my thoughts for today. So we have a couple of minutes if someone would like to say something that you feel needs to be said after all this. Jen?
Well, the first thing I was thinking about was that Buddha very possibly was a sensist. And we believe all these other stories about him, so maybe that one's true too. And all these other interpretations are trying to make him politically correct.
Right.
And I don't think that's really necessary because useful to women as they are to men, I believe. And the important thing is that the modern practitioners are not sexists. And the other thing is a little bit harder to say, but I felt like you were, the whole Dharma talk was given by a man, and you said a lot of things about women, and I was hoping that you'd
make more space.
Make more space for women to talk about how they felt.
Yeah, I apologize for that. That's one of the, you know, often I reflect on the fact that you know, I'm the main teacher here, that, you know, I can't very well, you know, make myself into a woman. You know, but yeah, it's very appropriate what you said. It's true. I apologize for that part. There will be a chance Friday evening for the women to speak. So if you feel you want to come Friday and feel like you want to speak about some of these things or something, it's built into the event. And it's built in such a way that, I won't say. And the first thing you said was very wise, and I very much appreciate that. And I think that we have to, the Dharma only exists in the people who practice it. And if freedom is a possibility, it's only possible in the people who practice freedom. And I don't think we need to burden ourselves with the history of Buddhism, of how things have or have not been in the past. I think many times people think that if I'm going to be involved in some way with Buddhism, with Buddhist practice, the whole religion has to be right. You know, otherwise, why would I associate myself with it? Like, or if I'm going to accept the practice, it means I have to accept the whole thing. But the whole thing, part of it's sexist, so that's a problem. My understanding of practice is you don't have to accept Buddhism at all. Buddha never wanted anybody to become a Buddhist. But rather, what's being offered is a practice of freedom. And so how do we find our own way in that practice of freedom? So how do we use the resources of Buddhism to help us in that direction? And how do we avoid those resources which are get in the way of that? That's basically, I think, what you said, right? I shouldn't put words in a woman's mouth. Sort of. Yes? Right.
And I guess I'm starting to see, you know, that my practice is based on a freedom that is available to anyone, enlightenment is there, but it's also based on being in this body, in this time, and on being a woman. And so there's something particularly beautiful to me in that kind of paradoxical appeal that was made to the Buddha, at which point he said yes. And it's in contrast to what you were talking about, Jainism, or even early Christianity, where women were said, you can be saved, you can achieve enlightenment if you become male. So it seems like a very different foundation. But then the follow-on question to that is, being in a female body will obviously give rise to different experiences than being in a male body. Even perhaps a different way of thinking based on biological differences. And if these differences have existed over time and still exist, and the majority of teachings have come from men, I guess the open-ended question I have is, as women more and more teach what they're learning and explore their experience as women practicing, how will the nature of what's being taught shift as women's bodies inform
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. And there certainly are plenty of women teachers now in the last 20 years in America. So, we can start tracking a little bit how they're teaching and how it changes, how it changes things. About 8 years ago, I counted the ratio of men and women teachers who were teaching retreats, Vipassana retreats in America, as revealed through the Inquiring Mind listing of retreats. And I found, I don't remember exact numbers, I think it was 54 different teachers, Vipassana teachers, were teaching retreats in 1995 around the country. And to my surprise, it was exactly equal, men and women. And I've noticed a little bit the differences. I've tried to pay attention a little bit, a difference in how men and women teach Vipassana teachings. And I haven't really noticed that much difference overall. But one of the little differences I've seen is that I've never heard of a male teacher, Vipassana teacher, use the language of being a warrior, spiritual warrior, which is part of the tradition. There's lots of teachings like that in Asia, being a spiritual warrior. And I think that there's some reluctance for men to put that message out because they're men and all that means and all that. But it's the women teachers who say that. Not all of them, but there's some of the women teachers who give these talks, be a spiritual warrior and be a warrior. So there's a difference. So the issue is freedom found in spite of our conditioning, our condition, or is it found through it, with it? And you're, in a sense, I think, arguing for the latter, that you find it through it rather than in spite of it. Yes?
This just made me think of something. Maybe enlightened being shows more of an androgynous mind where they are equally male and female, where it isn't the outside appearance of a sex side, whatever, but it's the inside inner awareness of the merging of man and female equally. And that, I think, is part of enlightenment in my sense. And I also kind of think women have an edge. I think that women because we're constructed for childbirth, our cells and our structures are much more sturdy than men. And we think of men as running around with big arms and going after saber-toothed tigers, whatever. It's to me, that's really important in terms of pushing and making something happen. But I feel women are much more designed to expand and hold everything. So in a sense, we process things with a little bit more flexibility. And so, I don't know why I decided to speak. But anyway, that's what I came up with.
Yes?
As you were speaking, I was having the picture of what it would be like to go to my son and request to be ordained, and that was sort of humorous, looking at both ways. Yeah. And then, but the other thing that really came through as I thought of Mahaprajapati was that she was a woman who was in a situation that she didn't necessarily choose all of the characteristics of. She didn't probably choose to be a widow. She didn't choose to be a stepmother. She didn't choose to be a queen that found herself responsible for all of these widowed women. And yet that was just the suchness of the situation. And that was just what she had on her plate.
Yes.
As I was listening to all the explanations of and interpretations of what the Buddha could have meant, I came to the conclusion that I don't know which one of those is true, but I I was reminded myself that I think that the Buddha was liberated and enlightened, and I don't see how he could have been both liberated and sexist. I just don't see how those two things could have coexisted. So.
I think that's a little bit along the lines of what you said, but on a spiritual path, to me, means that I would eventually, just following that way, would mean that I would be able to, or the goal for me personally, is to be able to transcend the constraints of body as to learn how to be more human. And I've always looked at it that way. In the process, I do accept myself more fully for who I am, and I am a woman. But that is the attraction for me, and that is the passion for it. I feel for it is because it allowed me to do that, to become more human. I mean, all the traits of compassion and kindness, those are essentially human traits. They're very spiritual traits, but we're humans, and we have the ability to express these things if we can get in touch with them. And it has never dawned on me, and it still does, and even with the questions raised, that I would be constrained by my sex. Maybe it would give me benefit in some way. Maybe I can feel maternal or whatever it is. I guess, but it just never occurred to me that my sex would constrain me. And that is what it says.
Mm-hmm. There's a difference between, for example, saying that women can become enlightened and saying that women can become teachers. Because some people acknowledge that women can become enlightened, but they won't give women the chance to become teachers. You know, that tends to be something that's granted in Buddhism. And there's been a long history of women who have not been granted that permission or that responsibility. You know, as far as we know, it was taught by the Buddha in his time. Mm-hmm. It's pretty ancient. Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
I don't know if I'm totally off the wall in saying this, but I had a very different perception of the Buddha's intention in making women supposedly subservient to men, and that the greatest gift of Buddhist practice for me has been the gift of humility. And were I an enlightened being, and I was asked to be humble to someone who was far lower than me in his place of enlightenment, I think it would be a tremendous gift to me to express that humility, and a tremendous gift to someone who was working on enlightenment himself to receive such a gift from someone. So I'm wondering if the Buddha wasn't giving women a tremendous gift and saying, you will be so great in your humility that you will be able to bow to the least of the male monks in among you. And I thought that is what came up for me. And I don't know if this is just my rationalizing the Buddha's actions, but that's what I felt as you were speaking.
I'd like to just make a small comment on that. Because when, Tenzin Palmo, the nun that Gil mentioned before, she started a monastery for women, and the reason that this came about was because the Tibetan nuns had such incredible low self-esteem for being treated this way for so long, and they had such a lack of self-confidence and lack of self-worth, and so these nuns now were being trained already there. It's just, she says it's been like, complete change. So if the Buddha had the vision of what this would do, I don't think it created more freedom. I think it perpetuated this feeling of women as being less than. Mm-hmm. And I think it has been perpetuated over the years, throughout Asia and wherever that tradition has continued.
Just to say, I've lived in West Africa for a number of years, and it's Islamic culture, and the women were not allowed in the mosque, in the family situation, in their prayers. The women would pray behind us, and they also had to have their head covered, their hair, and I don't know what to say, but it was almost so through the thread of the fabric of everything, it's almost like you're blinded to it. I mean, I could see it because I came as an outsider and I see things differently, but if I grew up in that environment and men just kind of had their place, women had their place, and things were the same, you could tell the fuck, it was just old. But if that's the way it always has been, and the idea that you can question that doesn't even come up. So that was kind of the sense I got of being there for, 3 years and in several countries, and uniform
and
the same.
It was, a couple of months ago, Cheryl, I saw the documentary was Women for Women. And it was really interesting because it took place in India, in Hindu culture. And the culture isn't that much different from how we stereotypicalize Islamic culture. The women were not. They had to be escorted by men. They were subservient to men. So it's an ancient cultural thing in a lot of cultures in this world.
My hope is that, right now there's a few different monasteries, Theravadan Buddhist monasteries in the West. Ajahnamurros and place up in Ukiah and Thanissaro Bhikkhus in San Diego and a few other places. But in America, at least, there are right now there's no nunneries. There's no places in the Theravadan tradition where just nuns live Nuns can kind of live a little bit at these monasteries, but they're not really treated completely, egalitarian kind of way. And I hope that one day that not only will there be, places in the West where women can kind of go and practice in a very powerful way and be their kind of their own, powerful retreat centers of their own. My hope is that we have both monasteries and nunneries right here in the peninsula. And then we have some place maybe right up here in the foothills, some little cheap little plot in Woodside or something. some place close enough so the monastic communities can be in relationship to our center and kind of the lay life that we live down here. So I hope that someday we'll have a place both for men and women.
You mean together?
Both together and separate. Yeah. I spent a year or some time in Japan, also in Asia, in Southeast Asia, but in Japan, all male monasteries. And I thought it was actually quite great to do that. And it had great value. I kind of first practiced in situations where the men and women practiced together, like at Tassajara. And monasteries there. And I really valued the year that I spent in an all-male monastery. And I projected from that my hope is that it would be really valuable for women also to have that opportunity. There's something very valuable when women get together as a group and practice together. That's equally valuable. And it's very valuable when people practice together, too. All combinations are valuable. Yes? Yeah.
So when His Holiness came, was it last year, whatever, I was actually curious to see how the seating arrangement would be on the stage. And the women were seated behind the men all the way around.
Yeah, so some things are slow to change. I'm sorry to hear the story. Yeah.
Serious questions raised about how women are treated and whether there's submission and whether this is correct or incorrect. And as you said, maybe this is a gift to women to accept us, and it's not necessarily an indication of disrespect. And then there's this side of enlightenment that says that we're to get rid of most of our ego, our notion of self. And doesn't that also imply that we should not make a big deal over whether we're men or women anyway? And so maybe I would question, is it important enough to even be addressed seriously? Is it not better that we should move more toward enlightenment as a sort of single-minded goal, and leave behind this question of men superior, women superior, or whatever?
It's a big question, and I, from my opinion, at least I answered it earlier, where I said that I think part of what mindfulness practice involves is being very honest about what's actually happening. So rather than thinking of enlightenment as separate from it, you find enlightenment through it, in a sense. So that if what's happening is sexism, then it gets named. Last one, and then we'll stop. Someone, I saw you, several. So I don't know what kind of what I've opened up here. And I've been teaching now for about 12 years here for our group, and I've actually heard very, very little. I've tried various ways to bring up the issue of women, or try to find courage, you know, as a male, all the difficulties and awkwardness of that, presumptuousness of that, kind of to encourage various things for women. But I've heard very, very few women have actually come and talked to me about these kinds of issues, you know, directly. I don't know why. But certainly we've brought it up here today, and I don't know if it's an important issue to pursue or whatever. However, one of the things I learned recently is that it's very awkward to bring, it can be awkward to bring something up, something which is a tear in the fabric of culture or tradition or whatever, bring it up once, and then just let it, you know, kind of let it just sit, you know, and just kind of never talk about it again. It's like you're stirring up the dust, or stirring up it all, and then people feel a little bit like, oh, I feel this is a big deal, and now no one's talking about it anymore. I feel kind of, you know, there's no place to process it. So I don't know, you know, what's supposed to happen, but I just wanted to name that, and then and encourage any of you, all of you, to speak up or talk to me or talk to other people, because I'm a male, it's difficult to talk to me. There are other people here in the Sangha who are women. Susan Ezekiel, who's sitting up there, is our president, and she happens to be a woman. Or maybe I shouldn't say it that way, but she is a woman. And so you can always talk to her. And so I hope we have a nice time on Friday, and I'm looking forward to it a lot. And I'm looking very much forward to the idea of honoring, respecting, and celebrating the history of women in Buddhism, the women teachers and practitioners and enlightened women. And I feel very fortunate that I've had women teachers for myself in Buddhism, and I'm very grateful for them, and very grateful that I came into Buddhism at a time where it seemed like pretty easy for me to have both women and male teachers, and it wasn't a big deal. So thank you all.